This is the Airplane Geeks Podcast. Our aim is to educate and inform you, explore and develop your passion for aviation, and entertain you a little along the way. This episode, we talk with three high school students who won the EAA's Founders Innovation Prize competition with their Remora system, which takes sensor inputs and displays airspeed and angle of attack on a head-mounted display. In the news, we look at the decline in short-haul traffic in the U.S., how the U.S. Air Force is responding to the flight crew shortage, using airport data to improve efficiency, the grounding of the MRJ test fleet, and AOPA taking action against egregious FBO charges. All that and more coming up right now. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 467 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight. Joining me first is another Max, Max Trescott. He's host of Aviation News Talk Podcast. He's a CFI, an author, and a glass cockpit expert. Max Trescott, how are you?
Max, I am awesome. I've been on here for a week or two, but you and I were doing the same thing at the same time, which was staring at the sun. I was out in Illinois and back home now, but had a great time.
And did you get clear skies and a good view of the eclipse?
Yes, we did. It was spectacular.
It was indeed. Also with us is Rob Mark. He's senior editor at Flying Magazine. He's also a flight instructor, and he's publisher of the Jetwine blog. Hi, Rob.
Hey, hi, guys, and I understand we're going to have a plethora of maxes tonight.
That's right. We're going to max this one out for sure. Best I could come up with on short notice.
I can't believe I didn't think of that. Oh, Max, this is not good. You're going down a bad road here.
I think so. Well, okay. Let me also introduce someone who's not a max, and that's David Vanderhoof. He's our aviation historian who blogs at whatjustflewby.com. Hi, David.
Hello. I did not see an eclipse, nor do I live in Chicago. So that rules me out for all of the above. So looking forward to a good show. I had a very exciting flight with one of our guests, Father's Day, and he was charming enough to let me borrow his father for an hour or so I could go flying. So I appreciate that. But I think we should introduce our maxed out guests.
That's right. Well, you may recall in episode 463, we mentioned that three high school students were awarded the Airbus-sponsored top prize in the EAA's Founders Innovation Prize competition. Those students were from Thomas Jefferson High School for Science and Technology, and they are Thomas Barron, Max Lord, and Justin Joe, and they are with us for this episode. So, gentlemen, welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Now, the team's concept is called the Remora system, and it takes, as I understand it, sensor inputs and displays airspeed and angle of attack on a head-mounted display. Thomas, we're going to talk about that in a lot of detail shortly, but Thomas Jefferson High School for Science and Technology is a rather interesting school. Can you tell us a little bit about that school?
Sure, yeah. So first of all, thank you for having us. So into Thomas Jefferson High School. So we're based in Fairfax County, and in Virginia, we have these schools called, I think they're called governor schools. And I think there's 13 in Virginia, and Thomas Jefferson High School is one of them. And we're focused on science and technology. So from what I understand, there are other schools that are focused on literature and other things, but we're the science and tech school. And you have to apply to get into our school. So I think the acceptance rate is quite low. You take a test and then you write some essays, sort of like how you would to get into college. And then from day one, you're sort of molded into a scientist or engineer. So actually, that's how Justin, Max, and I met. And that was in our freshman IBET class. So that's our teamed biology, technology, and English class, where we sort of blend all three together. So we spent most of our freshman year together, and you sort of progress through the years. And now that we're seniors, we're actually in the senior technology labs, where we do some research about whatever we choose. And there's 14 labs that we can choose from. There's the chemistry lab, neurology lab, and it just so happens that Max and I are in the mobile and web app development lab, and Justin is in the energy systems lab.
Fascinating. This sounds like a facility, a school that offers some real advantages for those who are looking into science and technology and engineering and so forth. So it sounds like a really, really outstanding program. And we're excited to talk about the Remora system and what you guys have come up with in a few minutes. But first, we're going to start with some of the aviation news from the past week. So I'll ask, is everyone ready?
Oh, yeah.
Ready from the West.
Yep.
Our first news item comes from an article that was published in LinkedIn. This is What Caused Short-Haul Traffic Decline in the U.S., the $34 billion question. And this was written by Courtney Miller, the co-founder, the guy that originated, really, this podcast back in 2008. And this was great to see. Boy, what a comprehensive piece this is. It's really fascinating. Sort of to kick it off, we'll mention that, Courtney took a look at some of this data and found that the total U.S. domestic market has grown about 30%, almost 30% since the year 2000. But short-haul traffic has declined by almost the same amount, almost 30%. This is traffic under 500 miles. And when you break it down even further than that, the shortest travel has decreased the most. So the question is, well, how come? What's going on here? Why has short-haul domestic traffic declined so much in the United States? And Court looks at three theories. Airline consolidation has led to a drop in short-haul service. That's one. Second theory, pricing has increased disproportionately on short-haul segments. And the third theory, increased security requirements and the, quote, hassle factor have made alternative surface transportation favorable to flying on short sectors.
Ding, 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 ding. We have a winner.
Yeah.
I agree with number three. I mean, given the choice between flying the airlines and anything else, why wouldn't you drive?
Well, but I think one of the things that came out of that that was interesting is that if there were direct flights, people said they would take them. But when you add a stop in there and a change of planes and all the possibilities of getting stuck or being late or whatever, they just go, it's not worth it.
Yeah, well, those plane change add hours, and suddenly the equation really starts to tilt toward driving. I agree. I try and get nonstops whenever I can.
Yeah, and when I'm traveling, I look at the total travel time, which includes 45 minutes to get to the airport, waiting at the airport, the actual flight, and then the reverse on the other side. And for relatively short distances, it's faster to drive by car. Another thing is that I think as the hassle factor increases, I know at least my desire to make the journey part of the adventure rather than strictly the destination becomes a larger component of it. Of course, being retired and being a little bit more flexible in terms of time and, driving past something that looks interesting that, you would not have seen if you'd flown over it and stopping and checking it out, all that becomes a lot more attractive. But I don't know.
And it's interesting the way he broke this down. He broke, you said it below 500 miles, it's a decline, but he chopped it up into 100-mile segments. And for 400 to 500 miles, virtually no change. And I can see that. You know, 500 miles, I'm not really interested in driving 500 miles. But then in the 400 and under, that's where you see most of the decline. And it appears, by and large, the shorter the distance is, the bigger the decline. So people are more likely to drive, you know, 300 miles than they were 100 miles.
And let's face it, gas is still fairly cheap.
Well, that's a good point, David.
It's still sometimes cheaper to drive to these places and spend some extra time than it is to fly.
Well, and at the other end, you save the cost of having to rent the car and all that hassle because you drove. You've already got a car.
Yeah. Well, as with all of our news stories, we'll have links to them in the show notes, and we can really recommend taking a look at this article. He goes into a lot of depth and has done apparently a lot of data analysis with that. We should mention that for those of you who don't know that Courtney is now director of lessor sales at Bombardier Aerospace. He's based in Texas now, isn't he?
I think he's been down in Texas for quite a long time.
Oh, has he? When did he leave Wichita? Yeah.
No, I think he's in Wichita. I think he's out of Texas. Courtney, send us a message, just Morse code or something. Let us know you still actually care. Yes.
That's if you remember who we are, Courtney.
All right. Our next item comes from military.com. This is Air Force boosts pay incentives, targets retirees amid pilot shortage. We talk about the shortage of pilots and flight crew and cabin crew in the commercial aviation sector, but the military sector has issues as well. And what we see here is aircrew incentive pay, also called flight pay, is seeing an increase from $840 per month for aircrew officers to $1,000 a month, and from $400 per month for enlisted aircrew members to $600 a month. And it's not just pilots. It also applies to jobs such as boom operators and flight engineers and loadmasters and flight attendants. And even, interestingly, David, enlisted RPV, remotely piloted, or RPA, remotely piloted aircraft airmen flying the RQ-4 Global Hawk. David, do you think this is going to help the situation?
It's a tough call. Right now, the forecast is 1,000 pilots shortage by 2022. Pay is one factor. I was at Dover's air show this weekend, and next to four aircraft were two sets of air crews. There were two A-10s and two F-15Es. The F-15Es had just gotten back from a six-month deployment. The A-10s were scheduled to go on a six-month deployment overseas within a week to 10 days. It's becoming a tough life. You're hardly home. Now, when you sign up for the Navy and you go on a cruise, that's a whole different lifestyle. The Air Force is not used to this long-term rotational business like the Navy's been doing all these years. When you go out on an aircraft carrier and you're a pilot, you're out for 6 months and then you come home. The Air Force has never been that kind of rotational business. I mean, we had people rotate in Vietnam and Korea, but this is, people are going back to Afghanistan, Iraq, the Middle East three or four times. So there's a cultural issue as well as just money. I mean, and if you can fly an airliner for the same amount of money, if not more, not get shot at and come home after a week to 10 days, that's a lifestyle difference.
Yeah, I guess so, huh?
It's a challenge. And I don't know if the pay increases here are nice, but I don't know, 6 months in a desert and getting shot at, I don't know if it's worth an additional $140, $160 a month.
Well, you know, something I was going to mention, too, is I was reading a story over the weekend about that collision with the it was the John S. McCain. Was that a missile cruiser? Do you know, Dave?
Yeah, it's a guided missile cruiser. Yeah.
And they were talking about the difficulties that they're facing in the Navy as well, because of the cutbacks and how everybody says we've got to learn to do more with less. And they're getting pushed to the point where people are going out on these, at sea deployments that are longer than they used to be. And they're getting shorter and shorter time breaks in between. And I don't know how much longer the U.S. military is going to be able to keep doing more with less. We haven't seen any change to the military budget, I don't think, right? That was a proposal, but that's not signed yet.
It's not signed yet, but there's been a substantial increase. But with that increase, you for equipment, et cetera, you start, there's not the recruiting culture that we have right now. We don't have a lot of people jumping in to sign up for the military because of the current situation with us being in so many conflicts. I mean, Afghanistan is 16 years. There's a culture issue as well as, the military is a great career. Don't get me wrong. But when you are in the Army and you're going overseas every 2 years, or you're in Navy and you're going out on a 6 month deployment and used to be 6 months home, 6 months out, and now you find out you're going 6 months out and 3 months home and then 6 months out, it's all a factor of training and consistency. And we had two major in the South Pacific, we had two major collisions, which shouldn't happen to United States naval vessels. That just shouldn't happen. And it's, people are tired. They're overstressed. There's a real culture issue in the United States military. And this is coming from the military historian. We need to support, we always do support our troops, but there's got to be some sort of, we need more ships, more men, more people, more airplanes, because we can't keep doing what we're doing.
Yeah, but you know what? Everybody keeps saying that, but no one seems to focus on whose job it really seems to be to make that happen.
Well, it's been the last 8 years we've had serious cuts to our defense budget. And with no relief on sight. So at some point, Congress has got to step up and realize that we either stop fighting or we start supporting and doing more, stop doing more with less and doing more with more. Drones are not the solution, they don't replace people, computer technology and software doesn't replace people. You need good sailors on ships that can override computers that might have had viruses. Drones don't replace a pilot that can interact with ground troops better on an emergency. All of that, there's a culture of technology, 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 and we're losing the fact that our biggest piece of technology is the United States Solar Sailor, Airman, or Marine. The men and women who fight for this country are the best technology we have.
Well, that's interesting to hear that all come together from that side, David, because that's, of course, what we've been talking about on the pilot side for quite a long time, that the technology has been kind of aimed at trying to replace pilots, and that it's not going to be too much longer before we see airliners go down to one pilot because the computers are so good that they can handle most of the work and they just need that other guy there once in a while, and eventually no pilots. And, it's the same problem. And nobody seems to be getting that message.
Hmm. And the other angle on it, I think, that occurs to me is back to this quality of life kind of thing. Each generation has different expectations, different goals, and whether you're Boeing or GE Aviation or Embraer or Thales or whoever, whatever aviation company, you have to consider what the new folks coming in have for expectations, balance of life kinds of considerations and things like that. And I think it's the same in military aviation and military in general, is that, you know, you have to make yourself attractive as a career to these people. And what worked 20 years ago is not the same thing that will work, that worked 40 years ago. And what works today is not the same thing that'll work 20 years into the future. But you have to be kind of responsive to those things. And that's kind of difficult to do, because if you're a Boeing or if you're the U.S. Air Force, you are the status quo. And to look at that and say, well, you know what, we need to do something different if we're going to attract people to this is kind of hard to do. It's a natural tendency. But there are, I guess, a lot of different angles to think about. And to your point, Rob, who's figuring it all out, making it happen? I don't know, not clear. All right, our next item. This comes from Business Insider. How a Danish startup is using math to cut airport wait times in half. And this is about a startup called Copenhagen Optimization. And what they're doing is they're using data, airport data, to help airports run more efficiently, more smoothly, optimize the systems. And the article points out that airports have lots and lots of data. We have mathematical models now and ways to analyze big data, if you will, and that can all be used to optimize airport activities. So there's some results. Some of them are pretty significant. Others are a little bit more modest. Apparently, Copenhagen Optimization has taken a look at waiting time at Geneva Airport in Switzerland, and they reduced that by more than 50%. Dublin Airport, passenger throughput increased by 10%. At Stockholm Arlanda, the peak check-in counter times, the demand was decreased by 5.5%. So it's interesting. Data, big data, analysis of data seems to be coming up in lots of areas of our lives these days. And here we have an example of that taking place at airports, because Max Trescott, I think, as you know, and if Brian was with us this episode, he could certainly attest to the fact that airports are not always the most efficient operations.
You know, I wonder if not just big data, if they're using some of the old operations research techniques and, queuing theory and those kinds of things. I suspect that most airports don't apply those kinds of things. You know, but I could be wrong. Maybe these guys are using new cutting edge techniques. But I just kind of wonder if they're using things that have been around in other businesses and are finally just now being applied to airports.
Yeah, because that kind of optimization, like you say, has been around for a long, long time.
Exactly.
At least since the early 70s.
Yep.
Of course, it's all facilitated greatly with the growing power of computers to do these calculations. But yeah, this organization sounds pretty interesting. It might be kind of fascinating to dig into this company and see just exactly what they're doing and how they're approaching it. And then another story, boy, I really hated to see this one. you'll know why soon. This came from AIN Online. Mitsubishi grounds MRJs following in-flight engine failure. As you may be aware, Mitsubishi has four MRJ flight test airplanes in the U.S. And on one of them, FTA-2, they had an uncommanded shutdown of the left engine. Now, the plane was diverted to Portland International Airport. It landed reportedly without incident. These, of course, are powered by the Pratt & Whitney PW1200G geared turbofan. We had an interesting photo that was posted in our Slack team. It comes from LAX Spotter 97, and it shows the MRJ on the ground with a big, this looks kind of like an inflatable sort of tent around the wing, around the engine, so that the Mitsubishi technicians and the Pratt & Whitney folks can take a look at the that engine outside of the elements. So kind of unfortunate. We don't know at this point what caused this this shutdown. Hopefully it's not something too serious or something that will delay this program even more.
Not only away from the elements, but away from peering eyes.
Well, that's true. Hey, Rob, you're absolutely right. Yeah, you can't see through this thing, can you?
Well, let's talk about the PW1200G. I mean, how long has this thing been around? And is this you know, a proven engine that's been used other places? Or is this something new?
New.
No?
Yes. So it's essentially a smaller version of the geared turbofan that you'd find on the Bombardier C series, even a larger model that you'd find on the Airbus A320 family. So it's a it's a smaller version of that, basically the same technology. It's enough different, I think, to the degree where if there is a problem here, it doesn't necessarily mean that it's a problem across the entire geared turbofan family. But we have to wait and see. The latest update is that the engine has been removed and sent to Pratt & Whitney, where they'll conduct a thorough investigation. They've positioned a replacement engine with the MRJ there, and after Pratt understands what the real problem is here, then they'll look to put that replacement engine on the aircraft and fly it back. But in the meantime, and I think this makes sense, the entire fleet is grounded. You know, until you know exactly what's going on with this engine or some subsystem that affected the engine, you really don't want to be flying these things around.
So is MRJ the first company to use this engine?
Mitsubishi is using this, is the first on this size geared turbofan on the 1200G, yes.
Okay.
Okay, I'm going to ask, because I'm not an engine guy, and what makes a turbofan a geared turbofan?
So normally meaning for pretty much every jet engine before that, on the high bypass turbofans, the engines that have big blades in the front, those are driven on a shaft that's connected to a turbine section in the rear. And so the turbine section in the rear and the fan in the front turn at the same speed because they're connected to the same shaft. The problem with that is that for optimal efficiency, the turbine wants to spin fast. For optimal efficiency, you want a big fan up front that turns slowly. So what Pratt & Whitney did is put a gear system in that shaft up by the fan so that the fan can turn at a slower speed than the turbine in the rear. So that gets you, you can run a larger fan because you can run it slowly. Without that, you build a larger fan, then you have the problem of tip speeds of the fan blades being supersonic, and that causes all kinds of problems. With a larger fan, you also increase the efficiency of the engine because the fan generates most of the thrust. You also get lower emissions. You have this sounds like an advertisement, doesn't it? You have fewer airfoils in the engine because different stages are operating near their most efficient speeds instead of at some compromised speed. So you've got to compensate for that with lots of airfoils. And, of course, with a larger fan turning more slowly, you get significantly less noise, so they're quieter as well. So how does that explain it, David?
It does. And this segment has been brought to you by Pratt Whitney.
I know.
Well, gearboxes are complex devices. Has Pratt & Whitney been using gearboxes much for other things, or is this kind of a first major area where they've had to come up with a good gearbox?
Well, other than on turboprops, it's really... there is a gearbox, but it's not used for this purpose. So it's really the first use on this kind of an application. The company's been working on it for years and years and years and years. They say that there was a lot of initial concern about gearbox wear, and maybe that's kind of what you're hinting at. You know, if you're doing this new thing with these gears up here,
you know, what happens if a gear lets go, or what about wear of the gears and so forth. And everything I've ever seen from Pratt & Whitney on teardowns of test engines says that they see basically no wear in the gear system. So that part of it doesn't seem to be a problem, at least, you know, so far. Mm. All right, one more story. And this is an interesting one. Rob, you found this. This comes from AOPA. AOPA files official complaints over FBO fees. So, Rob, maybe you can tell us a little bit about what's going on here.
Yeah, well, my buddy Joe over at AOPA sent me this one earlier this afternoon because AOPA filed a complaint with the FAA. It's called a Part 13 complaint. It doesn't really matter why they call it that. In fact, because I don't know why they call it that, except that it's an informal request that the FAA go into the particular airport and look at the way the business practices are being handled. And what AOPA did earlier this year was to send out a request to members to say, hey, do you think that your local airport is charging people appropriately, or do you think there might be some issue that we should know about? And they got back, I forget what he took, but I think about 750 responses over the last 6 or 7 months. And what they found is that they started being able to prioritize where the complaints were, which airports seemed to generate the most complaints for what seemed to be predatory or unfair pricing of all kinds of services at the FBO, including fuel. And one of the top airports was right here in Chicago at Chicago Waukegan Airport, where I used to fly up on the north shore of the Lake Michigan, also Asheville, North Carolina, and Key West in Florida. And what makes the story even a little more interesting is that all of these airports have just one FBO, which most listeners will say, oh, well, there you go. And that does seem to be a problem. But what's even more interesting is that all three of the top airports that were complained about are run by FBOs are run by Signature Flight Support. And at last I heard, talking to Signature this afternoon, they didn't have a response yet. We might have something for that later tomorrow, I think, as I'm writing about that for flying. And so we don't know exactly what they're going to say other than, no, we didn't do that. But I think the fact that it's become a public issue and that there are hundreds and hundreds of complaints from pilots around the country that think they're being gouged on ramp fees and fuel costs and that sort of thing is pretty interesting.
And that reminds me of a quick story when I was in Albany, New York at the main airport, KALB, a couple of months ago with a gentleman. We brought his new airplane back from Kansas, and we landed at Albany. We had to go to the FBO so that he could get the keys from his car to the hangar. And we went, in and out, literally just to pick up the keys. And then they were going to charge him. And they said, well, we'll waive the whatever fee, but we have to charge you the airport landing fee. And he just laughed up. He said, I'm based here. There is no airport landing fee. They're like, oh, okay. I mean, so the takeaway I got was, man, I think some FBOs will just kind of nickel and dime people however they can. And sometimes they may fib a little just to try to tack on charges.
Well, sure. And I think one of the issues that has been a problem for GA pilots is that most of the airports, I'm not picking on any particular one, most of the airports these days have seen an increase in the amount of turbine powered traffic over the more traditional, little airplanes operating on aviation fuel. And so as some people would say, well, there's not that much of a need for aviation fuel, so it makes sense that the price is higher, except that overall some of these prices are astronomical. And when we talk astronomical, those of you that live in some smaller communities may be surprised to hear that some of the airports that ALPA looked at, 100 low lead was selling for about $6.50 or $6.60 a gallon. And you either take it or you leave it.
Hmm. What do you pay it at your airport, Rob?
Well, it's a mite on the high side. But then at Executive, we have a Signature Flight Support and an Atlantic and a Hawthorne Aviation. So it helps keep the price in line somewhat, but it's still pretty high. Hmm. Rob, notice how I completely avoided giving you a number?
Yeah, I did. Yeah. Yeah. You can look it up later.
I know what it is. It's actually, okay. Depending on how you buy it, it can be somewhere in the $4.75 to $5 a gallon range. And for what it's worth, too, Chicago Waukegan's only, I don't know, it's a 10-minute flight from Palwalk or from Executive. But of course, the only reason it's a little cheaper at our airport is that pilots moaned and complained and for years before anything changed.
David?
Rob, is there a consolidation on FBOs?
Yes, absolutely. Signature just, Max T, do you remember who is it Signature just bought?
I was going to say Landmark, but I don't remember. I mean, you're absolutely right.
I think that's right. And yes, David, Signature's the biggest of the bunch. I forgot how many they have, but they're international. And so, you know, when you control, we've heard that for years at our place, that when people didn't like the pricing, they'd say, well, go call Orlando, because Signature's based in Orlando, Florida. And they'd say, it's not our problem. We didn't make those prices. And but it's not real GA friendly.
So after the Part 13 complaint has been filed, what happens next?
I understand the informal process is for FAA to take a look at whether any of these complaints have any basis. Has Signature Flight Support actually been unfriendly to light aircraft, or is that just the opinion of these people that are filing the complaints? I mean, that is yet to be seen. And of course, there is a more formal process if they don't get the relief that they want, which is a Part 16 complaint. And no airport, that's a more formal, it's not a judge and jury kind of thing, but it's a much more formal process with FAA, and no airport wants a Part 16 complaint. In fact, they don't even want a Part 13 complaint because it just makes everybody very uncomfortable and everybody looks bad. So I think we'll have to see what Signature's response is to this.
Again, we're speaking with Thomas Barron, Max Lord, and Justin Joe, students from Thomas Jefferson High School for Science and Technology. They are winners of the EAA's Founders Innovation Prize competition. Justin, tell us a little bit about what the Remora system is, what its objectives are, a little bit about the value that it would provide.
Right. So the Remora system is a way for pilots to know all of their important flight information while not having to constantly check back to their avionics panel or their instrument panel. And the way we accomplished this was by making a sensor pod that ends up getting mounted on the outside of the plane, and it reads airspeed and angle of attack data. And then it Bluetooths that information over to a head-mounted display that will tell the pilot always what their critical flight information is, even when they're looking away from the instrument panel. And what that allows pilots to do is that when they're executing maneuvers and whatnot, that they always have a handle of what their critical flight metrics are and hopefully avoid loss of control accidents because of that.
And how did you guys come to select this as your project?
So when my dad was teaching me how to fly the airplane, or actually even when we were flying drones when I was really young, he was really big on maintaining your airspeed and being really, I guess, anal about, you know, exactly what airspeed you're at. So I think that's something that he got from the Navy, but he really imposed that on me. So I remember growing up and even flying in the Shark, you know, 60 knots, always be at 60 knots when you're on approach or something like that. And so creating something that would keep the pilot aware of his airspeed and angle of attack, just, it came pretty naturally to me. So it was, you know, kind of a product of that whole learning experience.
Now, Max, are you a pilot or a student pilot yourself?
Actually, no. Thomas approached me with this idea when he got the idea at the end of our sophomore year, and we're just entering our senior year now. We've been working on it for almost a full year now, or more than a full year. And it sounded like something I could use to help and use my programming skills to help him out with his project. And it kind of expanded into this massive project we were able to enter into the Innovation Prize competition.
And Justin, how about you? What was your interest, or what was your contribution to the project?
Well, what I did on the technical side was I designed the sensor enclosure that actually gets mounted on the outside, all the hardware, the aerodynamics and stuff like that. And Thomas and I have been involved for a long time. I've gone flying with him a lot. We used to be debate partners before that. And yeah, we just worked together on projects beforehand. And he knew that I know how to do CAD and SolidWorks. So he asked me to come onto the project when the time came.
Hmm. Can you tell us a little bit about the sensor pod? What is that like? What kind of sensors are in there? How was that designed? Or did you use something that was off the shelf?
So everything was pretty much designed from the ground up. What we did was we used the tie-down rings on the Shark, which is Thomas's dad's airplane. And we used that to clamp a 3D printed shell. It looks a little bit like a missile. And inside of it, there are holes drilled out for differential barometer sensors for your airspeed. And right now in our current design, we have a second set of holes 60 degrees away from the main airspeed indicator to find angle of attack. And then we also have a microcontroller and batteries inside as well.
You mentioned, I think, that the communication to the, I guess, to the cockpit is via Bluetooth?
Yep.
Right, but that's flexible. That's not something that is maybe set in stone.
What? Why not? I mean, what differences, what other options do you have?
So there's always Wi-Fi. One thing about Bluetooth is that it drops communication every once in a while. And so you have to get really reliable hardware and really reliable software. So sort of like low strain software, you could say, like something that isn't too difficult. You don't want to ask too much of the hardware, basically. So with Wi-Fi, when you drop signal, it's pretty easy to regain it. But with Bluetooth, that's not always the case. So we're not. That's part of the testing process that we have to go through. I mean, so far Bluetooth has never been an issue for us. But in the reading that I've done, sometimes Bluetooth has issues. So, I mean, that just comes along with the fact that we need more testing. So we'll see how that goes for us. But I wanted to point that out because, you know, Bluetooth isn't like a fundamental part of the design.
Right. Well, how about the headset? What are you using for that?
So the head-mounted display is off the shelf. It's made by a company called ViewFine. And there's a couple of reasons why we really like it. Primarily because it's very simple. So Google Glass was, and Osterhout Development Group's R7 glasses were sort of things that were in conversation when we were thinking of finding head-mounted displays.
Hmm.
But the problem with both of those pieces of hardware, the Google Glass and the ODG R7, is that they're computers. So they're kind of over-designed for what we wanted to do. And as a result, they're extremely expensive. So the ViewFind was nice because it's very cheap and it's also really low impact on the pilot physically. It's really small and you can take it on and off in the middle of a flight. So those couple of things combined made it like the perfect complexity for us. And it played really well into our philosophy of simplicity and low impact on the pilot. So that's why we chose the V-Fine.
Rob, have you, or Max Trescott, have you ever used a heads-up display of that sort?
I've never used one that was actually on my head. I know the it does sound kind of funny to people that don't know, but you know, typically the heads-up displays are a piece of glass that's focused correctly to be sitting between the pilot's eyes and their view out the cockpit window. So this sounds more like almost a military style helmet kind of system. Is that what that viewfinder? Because I haven't seen a picture, so
yeah.
Is that kind of what that viewfinder looks like?
The Viewfind is actually made for. It's like a consumer product. Like that, it's actually the purpose of Viewfind, the company. They wanted to sell it to people that use drones. So they wanted to be able, people like their pilots, to be able to see the drone while also being able to look through a screen. But our design, and I guess you could say why we incorporated the Viewfind, is inspired by the Apache and Mangusta helicopter head-mounted displays.
Ah.
So when I was reading up on the subject, I actually picked up a textbook from, you know, a couple decades ago. And they were talking about head-mounted displays. And I always like to look back into history as far as, like, you know, what's historically been successful. And the designs that those pilots use, and I think still use today, I'm not sure, so don't quote me on that. But at the time, they were one-piece headsets. So a typical military head-mounted display is something, like maybe in an F-35, it's like all-encompassing in that pilot's vision. Like, it's on the glasses, you could say. But what was different about these head-mounted displays and our head-mounted displays is it's only in one eye, which makes it easy to take on and off, which was not the purpose of the Apache and Mangusta helicopter head-mounted displays, but it's something that we took away from it.
Interesting. This is the product, I just Googled this, that V-U-F-I-N-E?
That's correct.
Great. Yeah, it looks like a very compact, very interesting little device. So, yeah, kind of perfect for this application. What were some of the... go ahead, David.
I was going to say, if we're going to talk about monocles, how do you handle the... can it be used over either eye, or is it just primarily for the right eye? If anybody's watched a really crappy movie called Firebirds, one of the major things is the helicopter pilot is left eye dominant and can't see out of the Apache monocle. And they have a very stupid solution, but it was a big deal in the Army when they brought out the Apache. So how do you guys handle, is it a one-eye system or a two-eye system?
So you can buy the Viewfind. Viewfind actually offers a left-eyed display and a right-eyed display. And that's not the only solution that we can come up with, too. Because we have a hardware box that goes with the Viewfind that we provide with the Remora system, or that we currently use right now, we could just invert the image as the pilot selects the other side, if that makes any sense. Traditionally, the standard is that the pilot uses the Viewfind on his right eye. But if they were wanting to use it on the left eye, all we'd have to do is invert the image for them, and it would be good as new for them.
Hmm. Interesting. Were there some particular challenges along the way that might be kind of interesting to our listeners?
I mean, yeah, there were plenty of design problems that we had to go through. I think Justin can speak to everything that had to do with the sensor pod. But as far as electronics goes, which is what I was responsible for, I think getting the proper quality of airspeed sensors was the biggest one. They're actually drone airspeed sensors, but they're actually very expensive. So I think that was the biggest issue that we had to go through. As also, the getting Bluetooth and wireless communication to work is always pretty finicky.
Yeah, if I could jump in as well, a big issue with the Viewfind we got was just finding a microcontroller that could output in the right display signal that we needed to do for the Viewfind, because it accepts like a micro HDMI or a mini HDMI, one of those weird small HDMI form factors. And for a long time, before we had our hardware box, we were using a tablet as an intermediary that had an HDMI out signal. And that was like a really clunky solution that we had for a really long time.
What microcontroller did you finally settle on?
Oh, we're using a Raspberry Pi Zero right now.
I knew it. How about that, David? David always gives me a hard time.
No comment. Where's the whipped cream?
Yeah, I tend to play with Raspberry Pis from time to time when I really should be doing other things. I'm sure you can sympathize with that. Max, when you were working through this project and doing this development, did you have your eye on the Founders Innovation Prize?
Actually, no. We created the project before we knew about, or we knew the prize was an option, and it just came up that we had the option to enter this in. We submitted our proposal, and we got a response from EAA asking us to come to Oshkosh and present for the final.
And I think you had some a little bit of help with preparing for that, didn't you?
Yeah, the previous winner, Ehab, we asked him for a little bit of advice on basically what to expect from the presentation. And he sent us a massive document, including like audience layout, judge layout.
Wow.
The amount of time you have. He was really helpful.
What kind of preparation did you have to do for that presentation?
Well, it was majorly focused on just practicing constantly. We went to each other's houses and reviewed the presentation over and over. So we just felt really confident when we were up on the stage delivering it because we had done it many times before.
Yeah, that's the key to losing that stage fright, or you know, whatever is making you nervous about performing some activity is lots of practice in advance. But tell us a little bit about the application process. So you submit a proposal and then you wait for a response. Is that Thomas? Is that how that worked?
Yeah, so basically what happens is the EAA has an email that you send. You have three options for your proposal. You can send a Word document, which is what we did. You can send a PowerPoint, and you can send a video. And you can do any combination of those three things. You can do one of them, which is what we did. And essentially, they're just looking for ideas that the name of the game for the Innovations Prize is to reduce loss of control accidents in the next 5 to 10 years. So it's not necessarily the best aviation invention. It's really about, you know, keeping the pilots safe, because that's what's plagued general aviation for a long time now.
Right.
So yeah. So what happens is you send in your application, whatever combination of those three, you know, mediums are, and then you get an email back around 3 weeks before the competition, before Oshkosh, and they tell you, you know, we've selected you as finalists. I was actually driving on my way home from work when I got a call from the organizer, and he said, hey, you know, we'd love to bring you out to Oshkosh. They were really nice about it. They paid for our hotel. They treated us like princes. It was pretty cool. They were really nice to our families as well. And at that point, you know, it's up to you to give a 10-minute presentation and then answer questions for 5 minutes.
What kind of questions did people ask?
The questions really were, they weren't really questions. So they described the presentation process as like a Shark Tank, which is a little bit misleading, because the questions that we got from the judges were more picking at us for more information. They weren't really like poking holes in our invention. Each of the judges had their own specific skill set, so I could tell that they were asking questions that sort of had to do with their field in aviation. So one question that sort of stands out to me is, Mr. Van Grunsven,
yep.
He asked us a question about what the pricing would be, which made sense for me. You know, when I was thinking about it, he probably asked us that question because, you know, he's in the aviation business. Mr. Goulian, the air racer, you know, he asked us questions about like practicality and things like that. But they were never, you know, questions meant to be detrimental to the, you know, to the invention. They were never taking away from us. Which is something that I thought was going to happen, you know, by the way that they described it online, like a Shark Tank situation.
Yeah, that's interesting, because I remember seeing the release that came out about that, and I thought it was going to be tough. I mean, they made it sound that way, at least.
Right. I mean, they asked us some really interesting questions, and I think if we hadn't prepared for them, we would have sort of made ourselves look like fools. But you know, that was a part of our preparation process. Actually, was we have a great network of people that we meet at air shows and fly-ins and stuff like that. So as soon as I meet them, I ask for their, or as soon as we're done talking, I ask for their contact information, and you know, I just try to get as many questions out of them as possible. You know, I ask them questions and I have them ask me questions about the remorse system. And, you know, we've got like maybe 15, 20 people that before we have some kind of event, I ask them questions. And, you know, those 15, 20 people really prepared us for the event.
And how long did you have to wait after your presentation to find the results?
We were the first to go. Then there were four other presentations. Each lasted about, you know, 15 minutes. And then they played a video by Airbus, and then they announced us as winners that night. So, you know,
it's probably about an hour and a half, maybe a little bit under.
Plenty of time to get nervous about the outcome, I imagine.
It was hard to get nervous about something we didn't really expect coming. You know, we really wanted to win, but it's hard to expect to win over the people that we were competing with. I mean, there was an astronaut, two university researchers, and a jet pilot. So three high school kids, you know, it's hard to expect first place.
So what was your feeling when you heard the news?
They actually announced fifth through second place first. And even when they called out second place and we were the only team left, it was kind of like, I think you can actually see in the video, it didn't really occur to us that we had actually gotten first place.
Wow. That must have been quite an experience. I'm sure your parents all were very, very proud as well.
I hope so.
Okay, so let's get serious. What happened to the 25 grand?
So none of it, I mean, we made a promise to each other that we were not going to take any of the money out for anything other than the project, obviously. The money is going into research and development. I think one of the big things that we talked about after Oshkosh was buying our own 3D printer. Because it's such a core concept and ideal that we have is to 3D print our products. We want to use 3D printing in the future. It's possible because, you know, the remorse system is not expected to be a high volume product. There are only so many airplanes in the world. So 3D printing seems viable to us because we want to be able to accommodate many different kinds of airplanes in a very specific way.
Hmm.
So buying a 3D printer made a lot of sense to us. So that was like the first big expenditure we had.
So you're looking to commercialize this. Have you formed a company or anything like that?
We're in the process of doing so.
Ah.
It's going to be under the name Remora System. Obviously,
systems,
right? Remora Systems. It's tough for us to work these things out. So we're in that process right now, and we're getting lots of help. So these things will come with time.
Very good. It's very impressive. How about the name Remora? What was the origin of that?
I came up with that.
Yeah.
So Thomas's plane is called the Shark, and the remora is a kind of fish that swims underneath the fin of a shark. So I thought of it one day. I was like, our pod is mounted under the wing of the shark plane. So with that just came, it's the remora system because it's under the wing of the shark. Yeah.
It's kind of brilliant, I think.
Okay, I'm not really worried about the next generation with these three on the show.
I know.
We'll be all right. I think we'll be all right.
I do, too. You know, when I think, David, when I think back to when I was in high school, a senior in high school, I guess I thought I was a pretty sharp guy back then, but compared to these three guys, boy, I don't know. I didn't know anything, I think. So, yeah, you guys are really impressive. I think you've probably gotten a lot of really good support, both at school and probably from your parents, which I think is really, really important. Did anybody ever doubt that you were able to accomplish such great things, or did you have that level of support?
I mean, our parents at a family level, I mean, obviously they will support us through everything, and they have been very, very supportive. Actually, I think that we have great support within the school as well. So I don't think there's any complaints that we can make at that level. We actually have a the three of us actually work on our on a cube satellite project at our school. So we're making a satellite for our school.
You mean like a satellite that's going to orbit the Earth?
Yeah, that's right. It's a 1U CubeSat.
Oh, yes, yes. Tell us, tell our listeners a little bit about that concept, what that's all about.
Sure. Not to mention the other host that has no clue what you're talking about.
Okay. Sure. So I guess just to break it down really simply, you know, when JFK was around and we were, you know, trying to build up our space program, the U.S. government was really interested in big satellites. And that made a lot of sense at the time. But now with advanced communications and stuff like that, the next big thing in space, and especially with the privatization of space, is satellite constellations. So with that, I guess the philosophy is you have lots and lots of small satellites. And those, you know, those satellites can be maybe like the size of a moped. But as an educational tool, Stanford and Cal Poly, I believe, came up with this concept of a CubeSat, which is a 1U CubeSat, or 1-unit CubeSat, is a 10 centimeter by 10 centimeter by 11 centimeter satellite. And so its original purpose was to educate their students. But since then, microtechnology has, you know, microelectronics has evolved to the point where these kinds of satellites can be commercialized. So in 2013, Thomas Jefferson High School for Science and Technology, which is where we go, was the first high school to launch a cube satellite. And we're at it again. And we're expected to deliver our CubeSat in August of 2018. Hmm. So
what does that launch on?
So we'll be launching out of the ISS. So it'll be launched out of a Peapod, it's called.
Wow.
So yeah, the three of us are actually, you know, we had that project. There's 80 to 90 people that work on it per year. And it's a really great learning tool for people. And not to mention, a lot of the kids that work on it, they end up, I work on it in school, they end up, you know, sort of, that becomes their career. And that's really the goal, is that we successfully create this CubeSat and then we're able to show it to lots of people to make space seem like it's close to them and that they can access it even if they're just at school.
Wow. Fascinating stuff. You guys are doing some really, really interesting things. Great, great stuff.
Thank you.
One of the things that we talk about frequently is, well, the pilot shortage or the decreasing numbers of pilots in aviation and the need to bring in more people, not just as pilots, actually, but just more people into aviation. And, of course, you want to have a pipeline, and that includes bringing youth and getting them interested in aviation. What are your thoughts? Maybe we'll start with Thomas. What are your thoughts on that topic, bringing more young people involved and interested in aviation?
So I think the biggest thing is obviously cost, but, you know, that's easy to talk about. But I think something that is maybe overlooked is I grew up on drones, and I think all three of us have owned a drone at some point in our life. And for me, it was like one of the big foundations for the Remora system. And it's also a big foundation for like how I learned to fly. And so I think if the general aviation community can embrace drones and find like good ways to integrate drones into how we teach people today, I think that would entice more people, you know, in our demographic to come to aviation. And like the only reason that Max, Justin, and I are able to participate in general aviation is because my dad and my mom were crazy enough to buy an airplane. And it's very unusual for someone, you know, like the only other way that I can think of is if you join the Civil Air Patrol. Hmm. So I think making it accessible is the big one. And I think the best way to do that is through drones.
David, does that sound familiar? It's something we've talked about.
I'm just wondering if I need to call 911 for Mr. Mark. Are you okay with that, Rob? I'm a little worried about your mental state right now.
Shut up, David!
I don't want to be stepping on any toes.
Oh, that's okay.
Yeah, well, I'm the pilot of the group, and since the drone thing has really come to
wow,
be, I've always said...
Wow, did you hear that, Mr. Max Trescott? He's the pilot of the group.
Oh, sure, right.
I'm standing by here quietly. I think what he meant was he's the only pilot that doesn't own drones in the group. I think that's what he meant.
That's right. A little more accurate.
And at the risk of droning on. Now, I always worry that one of those things is going to come through the window one of these days. So it's just a constant concern of mine.
Yeah, yeah. And that's
understandable.
Valid.
Understandable.
Sure, sure. And what David and I have talked about many times on the UAV Digest, the other podcast that we do, is that, as you mentioned, Thomas, unmanned aircraft, drones can be a great way to get young people interested in what could blossom into other interests in aviation, becoming a pilot or just entering into the aviation industry in some other capacity. If you get people flying anything, whether it's RC or drones or model rockets or what have you, it's a great way for parents and for schools to get younger folks on a path. You get them kind of started.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah.
Actually,
so was young. Let's not forget, though. So was Young Eagles.
Yeah. Well, yes.
Of course.
Yeah. Yes. So I mean, it's another path. Not the only one, of course.
Actually, I just a quick, I guess, anecdote. I was in Italy just 2 weeks ago, and my dad bought the shark from this small town in Italy called Tiene, and there's a guy there. His name is Simone. And he does everything at that airport. They have helicopters, hot air balloons, airplanes, gliders, and you name it. But one of the things that he does every Saturday, I think, is he sets aside time for the airport to just devote itself to drones and little kids. And he just teaches them how to fly. And that's kind of like the trap, you could say. It's like what gets them in to the airport. And then after that, the airplanes, the helicopters, the gliders, they all speak for themselves after that. I mean, how could you not be attracted to it?
Yes. Yeah. Perfect. I love that. That's great. As we were talking to you before the show started, you guys have started school already. And so we know that you need to drop off and get to your homework and other projects. But before we let you go, just really quickly, for others who might be considering entering the Founders Innovation Prize competition in the future, do you have any advice for those people?
I think actually I'll relay what Ahab said, and I'm sure Justin and Max have really great advice too. But really quickly, I think in his email that he sent to us, one thing that we really held true was no matter what you see and what you hear from other people, just stand by your product. And just like a quick story is when we had a 1 p.m. run through of our presentation. So our presentation was 8 p.m., but they wanted to do like a technical review beforehand. And so we got to meet all of the other contestants, and we met Michael Foll, who is, an astronaut. I think he's been in space 6 times. And since then, we've become really, really close friends, actually. But when we first met him, he told us about his product, and our products were quite kind of similar. And so it made us question a little bit, like, what's different from what do we do differently from his and stuff like that. And I think we were sort of worried at first, but then we remember what Ahab said, and that just stick with the product, run and gun, and see where it takes you. And so that would be my advice to anyone who's considering it.
Max or Justin, anything you'd add?
I would say just you need to put a lot of thought into it. And I think we talked with the judges after the whole competition was done, and they seemed to really like that we looked at the problem through a lot of different angles. We received a lot of great feedback from our neighboring pilots over at the Warrington Fauquier Airport and other pilots that Thomas's dad knows. And it's just important to realize that when you're building something for a community, you really need to work on all the feedback you're getting from a really diverse group of people.
I'd like to expand on that.
Yes.
The best advice I have, and the thing I think we profited from the most, is that we set out to get as much feedback as possible from our great network. And that was what really allowed us to make small changes after small change to really bring the invention to the best it could be.
Great advice. All right. Well, you've been listening to Thomas Barron, Max Lord, Justin Joe. And we want to thank you three guys for taking some of your busy day to speak with us and our audience. Just fascinating what you've accomplished. Sounds like there's an interesting future for all three of you. And stay in touch. I'd like to talk again in the future, hopefully. So thanks again.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Rob, was that you that commented that with students like those three coming up that we don't really have a lot to worry about? That they were really an impressive trio, I have to say.
No, I believe that was, I think that was Dave.
Yeah, that was me, but that's okay. Max doesn't give me credit for anything anymore.
Sorry, David.
The sharp kids, yes. You know, really, I guess they're not really kids. They're about to head to college, but they're a lot younger than the rest of us.
Yes.
Oh, they're still kids.
But they're a real inspiration. They make me feel good.
Yeah, I was thinking of offering some venture capital. I'd like to invest in their company.
Yeah, I know, huh?
I think we'll hear great things from them.
Yeah.
If we hear about that, would it be considered insider trading? Oh, no, they're not on the stock exchange yet, so
right.
We could just send the moolah and
No, it would be technically, since it's a startup, venture capital. Max is right.
Yeah.
Yep. No forward-looking statements here.
Okay. All right. Well, we have a lot of listener mail to catch up on. We'll try to get to as much of it as we can. But first, what's up with the geeks? Sorry about not having an episode last week. I was off chasing eclipses. Max T, you were doing the same.
I had great fun. I had never seen a complete eclipse like this before. I'd seen an annular eclipse where the moon was so far away that it covered the sun, but not completely. I think the most fascinating thing for me was as the sun was starting to get uncovered and there was that bright little teeny tiny sliver of sun, to watch shadow bands just dancing across and shimmering across the ground. I'd read about these, never seen them, but imagine, you know, little shadows about an inch wide and spaced an inch apart from each other. And they just kind of shimmered back and forth across the ground for maybe 20, 30 seconds. And that made the whole thing worthwhile.
Just
it was
amazing.
Just, yep.
So how come you guys had your glasses on and our president didn't?
Well, I'd saved mine from the last eclipse. But the other thing I was going to say, I was visiting a family. My uncle is 91. He's getting way up there. And so it was a great opportunity to visit him and to find out all kinds of stories about my family, since my parents are both long gone. So it was kind of fun to just kind of hear some stories, watch the eclipse. And then getting home was fun. From the time we got to the St. Louis airport to the time we got home, 24 hours.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, our nonstop flight got first postponed and then canceled then the following day. And it was like the trip that would never end. But you know what made it so easy? My wife was with me. Nothing like having, you know, your sweetheart with you. And the two of us just kind of took it all in stride. And it really wasn't that big a deal at all.
All right, good. David, you seem to be attending an awful large number of air shows this year.
Well, that's what I do. Everybody wonders why I'm so jaded, because I go to a lot of them. Now, I went to Dover, and Dover's convenient. It's only 45 miles away from my house. Got up lovely Sunday. Dover's a unique base. You don't often get to see at the end of the runway, like 8 or 9 C-5s packed together like they belong on an aircraft carrier. And there's also a squadron of C-17s. So they had a very nice static display turnout. They had Langley sent an F-22 up for static display, a pair of A-10s, a pair of F-15s, a couple of T-38s, almost all of the air mobility command, C-130s, a KC-10, a C-5, of course, a C-17. The only thing was missing was a KC-135, which I thought was kind of surprising. The jet team was the Suckbirds. I mean, the Thunderbirds. They never cease to disappoint me.
David.
Short story. They were supposed to schedule at 3:15. By 3:30, they hadn't moved. by 3:45, they just started to taxi. And the Thunderbirds did something really amazing. They taxied to the end of the runway, and the number four aircraft went from one seat to two seats and a fuel tank. As usual, they broke a jet. But while they were doing all of this, of course, the blue skies turned gray and got lower and lower. So what was a beautifully high sky up until 3:15, where we would have had a high show, they ended up doing a flat show. So as usual, the Thunderbirds never cease to amaze how bad I think they can be. If they would not spend 45 minutes walking around in front of the jets and actually get in the airplanes and take off, they might actually have more air shows. But the highlight of the show, though, was a C-5 demo, which is definitely not something you would see everywhere. And what you get is a new Super Galaxy, the new C-5M. Empty, does a pretty impressive takeoff and a pretty impressive landing, but it doesn't really turn on a dime. So it takes a while to get back around on the field. But on their photo pass, they did something on Sunday that they didn't do on Saturday, and something I've never seen before. And that was they popped all of their flares, both sets of flares from the nose and by the wheel wells, making a lovely strain of Christmassy red and green colors flying out of it, much to the shock of the announcers, as well as this photog who frantically was clicking the shutter as it went by, as it was dropping all of these flares. Most people have seen the angel created by a C-130 or have seen modern jet fighters pop one or two of them. I've never seen so many lit things come out of an aircraft before in my life. It was very, very impressive. So that made it up for everything else for the day. The C-17 demo was good. Art Nails had his civilian Harrier. But it was good overall, a very good air show and a very good day. And Dover, looking forward to Dover in two more years.
Great. So that's every other year, that show, huh?
Pretty much now, all of the air shows in the United States are going to be every other year. So next year, we'll have Langley and McGuire again. This year, we had Dover. So Dover will be in 2 years.
All right. Well, Brian's off on his South Africa trip. Hopefully, he's enjoying that. I guess he's going to be gone, I think, about a month, right? Quite a while. So hopefully, he'll send us some interesting reports. But we do have a positive airline story of the week. Neil sent this in, so this is great covering for Brian on this little segment. And I'll just read you what Neil sent in. Neil writes, "In response to your recent segment of positive airline stories, I wanted to relay my sister's recent experience of flying with Virgin Atlantic from London Gatwick to Orlando with her family to celebrate her 50th birthday. This was their first family vacation that involved flying, so the family of four were really looking forward to this very special vacation for them. There were four flying together, my sister, her husband, and her two daughters, aged 10 and 12. As this was their first flight, the girls were very keen to take David's advice and have a window seat, but they could not really justify spending £160, or roughly $212, to reserve their seats early. Being a more seasoned traveler, I advised her to be prepared and log in as soon as check-in opened, and they should still have a good chance of getting a window seat and sitting together on the 747. So she logged in just as check-in opened, only to find they had been pre-assigned seats, four together, but in the middle of the aircraft, so nowhere near the windows, much to the children's disappointment."
Boo!
I know. Well, he says, "I saw her just after this had happened, and she was really disappointed. I recommended that her only final choice was to go and have a chat with the staff at the airport when they arrived. I said that even though they missed out on the way over, to have a nice friendly chat with the person at the desk, mention the kids were disappointed, and see if they had any advice they could suggest to help my sister on the way back so they could maybe get window seats. Taking a leaf from Micah's book, I stressed her to be polite, friendly, and just ask for their advice, given that it was a special occasion and the children's first flights. I was therefore amazed and pleased to hear that Virgin upgraded all four of them to premium economy with two window seats when my sister had asked their advice. It was a fantastic, kind gesture from Virgin, and not only made their day and vacation really special, but has once again fired to more young people's imagination and wonder at their first flight. It also ensured that they could enjoy the world passing by from this unique viewpoint rather than just having their notes in an iPad. So thank you, geeks, for the opportunity to celebrate good service, and who knows what careers in aviation could be sparked by such a lovely introduction to flying. And that's from Neil. He's close to Heathrow. He's in Weybridge, Surrey, England. So really appreciate sending that in, Neil. If you have a similar story, a great story, some fantastic airline service, let us know. You can write to us as Neil did or make a little recording yourself. That's always great. And even with Brian out next week, I think, Rob, are you on deck for a good story next week?
Hey, I am actually. I have a good one from Southwest, and it's not just because I like Southwest. I mean, they went above and beyond.
Great. We'll look forward to that next week.
I hope I remember it. That's an awful long time.
Yeah, time to forget. Glenn sent us a little recording, a 1 minute recording, his thoughts on the Embraer KC-390. This is the aircraft where Embraer and Boeing have, recently, I guess in July or thereabouts, signed a teaming agreement where they're going to jointly market and support the KC-390. So let's listen to what Glenn sent along.
Hello, geeks. It's Glenn from here from New Zealand with some feedback about the latest podcast. Interesting in talking about the KC 390 from Embraer. I've heard it from some sources I wrote by or mentioned that we reckon there's a good chance the New Zealand Air Force will be buying those aircraft. But with an election on at the moment, I don't think there's going to be any announcements on actually whether they do buy them or not. It'd be interesting, though, because apparently I've heard that they've been supported by Boeing. Now, Boeing is providing all the spares and support for these aircraft. Yeah, we do need to get some new aircraft. Our C-130s are probably the oldest C-130s in the world, still in service. Yeah, just interested to hear about the case, what Dave was asking about the KC-390. Anyway, keep up the good work. Glenn out.
Thanks for that, Glenn. The site defenseforces.com reported back in July that this agreement with Boeing and Embraer, under this agreement, those two companies would pursue new business opportunities for the aircraft itself and for aircraft support and sustainment, where Embraer would provide the aircraft, Boeing would be responsible for in-service support. So it's an interesting link-up. All right, on to some listener mail. Mark wrote in and said, "I love sharing with you great TV shows that appear in the UK. This one is focused on EasyJet and follows rookie recruits starting out on their journey as pilots." Mark says it really goes to show how ordinary people from all walks of life can live their dreams, and it's very funny, too. So he's found two episodes on YouTube. We have the link to season one, episode one, Inside the Cockpit ITV. This was actually published earlier this month in August. It says documentary series follows new recruits as they train to become pilots for EasyJet. The program follows the rookies' progress from the classroom to the cockpit. I've watched part of it, not all of it. Looks pretty interesting. So thanks to Mark for passing that along, and we'll have a link to that video in the show notes. Then Patrick wrote in and said, "Thanks for an amazing podcast. It definitely keeps me motivated. I was just wondering if you know of a mastermind group for pilot online bloggers. Rob, you know what a mastermind group is?
Max T, you sound like you do. I have heard of it, but I can't remember what it is.
Yeah, I've been digging around in the background here because I looked at that question a few minutes ago and wondered. So it sounds like the concept has been around for more than about 75 years, and it's really just any group of people that meet periodically over a common interest to, you know, try and help each other get better at something. I did find a site that was mastermind.org, and one of the interesting things they said is that part of what makes it hard to – oh, it was masterminds with an S.org. Part of what makes it hard to find some of these groups is that they don't often use the name mastermind group for their group. But they did suggest just Googling mastermind group for XXX, and I put in blogs and – you know, you can find some groups there. I don't know that there are any specific to aviation blogs, so that's a pretty niche group, but maybe it's time to start one.
Yeah, and if you're listening, if any of you know of one, let us know and we'll pass it along. I have run across a number of mastermind groups in other areas. A lot of entrepreneurs or budding entrepreneurs take advantage of this, get some like-minded or people with a lot more experience and collaborate on goal setting, determining plans to achieve that goal, or those goals of the group, giving advice, providing solutions for roadblocks and things like that. It's kind of an interesting concept. So yeah, if you're aware of any that are specific to aviation bloggers, let us know and we'll pass that along. And we heard from Mark Newton. He writes in addressing David's question. He says, aside from the fact that the U.S. can regulate any carrier who uses their airspace, let's keep one thing clear. The foreign carriers don't need FAA regulations because they already provide sensible seat pitches. Sites like SeatGuru catalog them. If you do the comparisons, it's difficult to escape the conclusion that arguments about seat pitch are primarily a U.S. issue. Some of the super, super cheap European and Asian carriers are comparable to U.S. carriers, but they don't service U.S. ports. Once you discount them, you're left with a pretty stunning conclusion. Given a choice between a U.S. carrier and a non-U.S. carrier, if you care about Pax X, you're almost always better off if you give your money to the foreigners. Competitive market, but hands down, no contest. So thanks, Mark. Mark notes that he's got 120,000 miles in the last 12 months, if that matters, he says. That's getting up into Brian Coleman kinds of territory. Maybe not all the way up there, but that's a lot of miles. Subsequently, Mark wrote in and had a comment about our Smokey Joe's hot dog stand, the one we talked about outside Munich Terminal 2. Mark says, I heard the comments in the episode about how it probably wasn't called a hot dog stand because it was German. He says, well, that's true. I internationalized my email to you folks to suit the audience. I can understand that. He says, looks like they were mostly selling currywurst. I don't even know what that is, which is close enough to a hot dog to be an even money bet, in my humble opinion, says Mark. All right, let's see. Chris writes in, I just did my 8th and 9th solo flights today. Yay! And they were my first two flights in a single-seat glider. I live in Banff, Alberta, and the Invermere Soaring Center is a two-hour drive away. I enjoy the beautiful drive listening to past episodes, but I can only go back a year on my podcast app. You guys mentioned that if you have that you have archives of the show, but I can't find them. Is there an easy way to download more past shows? Well, there is, thanks to a very generous listener of ours. There are zip files by year at this website. It's airplanegeeks.oosz.org. Airplanegeeks.oosz, or Z if you're of that persuasion, .org. And they're cataloged, again, by year. So each year is about a gig or 1.2 gig, so it's a big download, but that'll give you the MP3 files for all of the past episodes, so you can download to your heart's content.
Hey, big shout out, boy. I was up in Banff a couple of months ago. It's really cool.
Banff is on my bucket list. I keep telling Drone Mama that we got to get ourselves to Banff. I really want to see that.
Do you know how many things you have on your bucket list?
Yeah, that's after, let's see, what? Oh, yes, Oshkosh, right?
Yeah, that's in Wisconsin.
Yeah, that's on the way to Banff, isn't it?
Well, I guess you could say that.
Whoa. Okay, this is getting bigger. All right, so Chris also goes on. He says, a good angle for a future show on soaring would be someone who runs the OLC website. The OLC is a site that lets sailplane, paraglider, and hang glider pilots from all over the world upload their flight tracks. It's competitive, and there are several categories of competitions, but they are mostly based on distance. Some are based on the highest average speeds, too. It's fun to see how other pilots are doing, as soaring flights are so variable, and it's unique in that you can assess your ability in relation to other pilots. He says it's fun to upload your flight at the end of the day and see who had the best flights in your club, country, and world that day. So this thing is OLC, Online Contest. So their website is www.onlinecontest.org. And it's, I just started poking around. It's kind of fascinating what they're doing over there. Chris says, thanks for helping make my drives fun and keeping me informed. Now, yeah, soaring, we need to get into that more. I remember a couple of years ago at the Uberhazy Center, we met someone from Mid-Atlantic Soaring Association and talked about getting maybe one of them on the show. But it never really didn't come together. Maybe this is a topic that we need to get into more. In a follow-up email, Chris sent us some other links about OLC. As an example, too, he says, here is Jim Payne's page from the Pearland 2 project. He has a couple of flights on another glider that lasted over 12 hours. By clicking the info box on the right, you can see a map and all the data you could ever want of the flight you select. This is pretty cool stuff. So look for that in the show notes. And we will finish off with one more video. This came in from Mark, a different Mark. He says, hey, geeks, how about this off-field landing? Or maybe it should remain landed. Check this one out. It's in Russian, but the title translates to Plane on the Road Accident. And I don't know, is this plane landing or taking? I think this plane is taking off.
Yeah, it's definitely taking off. It looks like a Citabria, and everything looks fine. The really weird thing is, you would think they'd be taking off down the middle of the road. They're literally taking off on the shoulder, if you look at the lines. And therein lies the problem, because as this plane speeds along, boom, it hits a car which is parked on the side of the road, and it is quite an impact. The other thing that's a little odd is the aircraft is taking off, and it's got its flaps down, and the nose is just pitched up. It's almost like he's been trying to pull it off the ground and just didn't have enough speed. Oddly, that may have actually delayed his takeoff, because if you've got the stick all the way back and the wing is tilted, that causes more aerodynamic drag and actually takes longer to get off the ground. But either way, this was not a great, not a well-thought idea. I've actually seen other pictures of aircraft taking off from highways that hit things. There was a Cessna 210 that took off from a highway and hit a parked emergency vehicle that was on the side of the road. So, yeah, I mean, this is not the first time, you know, someone has not thought out their takeoff.
Yeah, they don't blow up.
Well, that's true. I mean, that's just everybody believes in the, you know, when you see what happens in the movies that, oh, an airplane hits something, of course, there's boom. And, of course, that's just Hollywood. Yes, sometimes they catch fire, but most times they don't.
I think this video is, and it's very short, so look for it in the show notes. You can play it right from within the show notes. I think this is taken from a dash camera. I think the Russians are big into dash cams. And I think that's what this is. All right, well, we're going to bring this one to a close. Want to thank you for listening to the Airplane Geeks podcast. We really want to thank our guests, Thomas Barron, Max Lord, and Justin Joe, the three students from the Thomas Jefferson High School for Science and Technology who won the EAA's Founders Innovation Prize. Just a spectacular achievement. Great to have them on. Really enjoy talking with young folks as well. As always, you can find us at airplanegeeks.com. The show notes for this episode, you can go straight to by visiting airplanegeeks.com/467. On our website, you'll find links to all the places you can find us on social media, Twitter, Facebook, and so forth. Also, our email address, which is thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. It's all on the homepage at airplanegeeks.com. Let's tell our listeners where they can find us online. So, Max Trescott, we'll start with you.
They can find me at aviationnewstalk.com, or they can find me on Twitter. Just go ahead and follow Max Trescott.
But you keep pumping out great Aviation News Talk episodes, Max. They're really spectacular.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, I just put out the last one on. We were talking about the unstable approaches and all the many things that go into making a stable approach. And I was really surprised. You look at the FAA's handbook, and it doesn't talk about a lot of the aspects of a stable approach. So, yeah, I had fun putting that together.
Great. And Rob Mark, where do people find you?
Well, they'll find me at any place that has Jetwine in the name, or probably at flyingmag.com.
And David Vanderhoof, tell us where we can learn more about what you've got going on.
You can find me on Twitter at DM Vanderhoof. You can find me on Instagram. I've been posting a lot of pictures from the air show, and I'm really happy I got my new camera. And you can always find me on Fridays, unless there's a solar eclipse, with that guy, Max Flight, doing the UAV Digest. So we look forward to talking, droning away for another week this week.
Yeah. I'm responsible for not having two podcast episodes, different podcasts.
Let's think about this. The first lunar eclipse is the only thing that will prevent Max from doing podcasting for a week and miss all of his shows was a 100-year lunar eclipse.
Solar eclipse.
You got to admit that.
Solar eclipse.
Solar eclipse. Okay, well, I'm an airplane geek, not an astronomy geek. Sorry.
The moon's involved, but yeah, okay.
You lunatic, you.
No, thanks.
Shadow chaser.
Oh, there we go. You can find me on Twitter at Max Flight. Look for me on LinkedIn, as David mentioned, at theuavdigest.com. Also on paxexpodcast.com with Mary Kirby. We have an episode out recently. Great conversation with an executive from GoGo. Look for us on the Airplane Geeks Slack team. Learn more about that at airplanegeeks.com/team. Our intro music is by Brother Love. He's at brotherloverocks.com. Outro is by Bruno Massone. Find more of his compositions at brunomassone.com. So please join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Thanks for listening.
Keep the blue side up.
And what Rob said.
What? I can never remember what I'm supposed to say. Hey, and Max Trescott, I just want to say that contrary to popular belief, as I said, I am one of the pilots. I'm one of the pilots in the group is what I said. I don't know what everybody's so upset about.
Yeah, go ahead and try to salvage that, Rob.
I was going to say, Rob, sorry, I really got you off the bat there.
Let's go to the videotape.
I don't know. You can believe whatever you want. I know. I mean, I said the best thing possible. I said, absolutely. There's no one that could have said it better than I did. So exactly. I know what I said, and I said, what did I say? I said yeah. that I'm one of the pilots. Hey, listen, if it works for Trump, if he can just change it after he said it, why can't I?
Yeah, why not? Why not?
And I'll be fair, Max Trescott, he is not the only pilot that owns a drone on this organization also. Rob does own a drone.
Yeah.
Oh, you absolutely. Got that little one, right?
A little baby one, yeah.
Yeah.
Little teensy weensy one.
But he does own a drone. See, I'm backing you up on this one, Rob.
Yes, thank you. Thank you.